From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, French families remember America's war dead, a new dawn for women in the Iraqi city of Basra, and murder most foul in India. On Memorial Day, we broadcast a report from the coast of Normandy in France. It was about a French volunteer organization that adopts the graves of American soldiers who died during the World War II D-Day invasion and are buried there. The story has a personal touch, as it was brought to NPR's attention by one of our listeners whose uncle fell in Normandy in 1944. Eleanor Beardsley tells the story.
High on a bluff above Omaha Beach, the American cemetery at Colville-sur-Mer is a place of stunning beauty and tranquility. Rising from thick, manicured grass, rows of white crosses and stars of David face westward towards America. It's hard to imagine that 64 years ago war raged here, but there are 10,000 graves to prove it. Among them is the uncle of a North Carolina NPR listener, Jenny Malcolm. Walter Malcolm was killed near here 2 months after D-Day. Last summer, while investigating her uncle's death, Jenny Malcolm came across the French volunteer organization Les Fleurs de la Mémoire, or Flowers of Memory. Jenny Malcolm said she mustered up her best French and asked if flowers could be placed on her uncle's grave. 2 months later, she received a photo of his grave in the mail.
It had been prepared for a photograph with sand taken from the beach, filling in the letter form so that you can see the contrast between the letter forms and the white marble, with a beautiful bouquet of flowers. And it was quite an emotional experience to receive that.
Marie-Thérèse Lavieille, who founded the organization 8 years ago with her husband, says it's important that each soldier be remembered when their own families can't come anymore.
When we join, we promise to visit the grave and to lay flowers on the grave. And sometimes the people take flowers from their own gardens.
This year, dozens of members of Les Fleurs de la Mémoire have shown up at Colville-sur-Mer for the annual Memorial Day ceremony, which begins with a flyover by U.S. fighter jets in the missing man formation.
Notre Père, qui es aux cieux.
A French priest recites the Lord's Prayer, then a rabbi chants the Kaddish, and a French military band plays the Star-Spangled Banner. But behind the grand ceremony, a simple tribute unfolds at the back of the cemetery. 50-year-old Jean-Michel Miette kneels in front of the grave of Jenny's uncle, Private First Class Walter C. Malcolm. Miette is the one who adopted Malcolm's grave, and he has come from Paris this morning to honor him. He has brought flowers and written a letter.
I want to read something for Walter. I'm apologize because I must speak in French. Okay, cher Walter.
Jean-Michel Miette, like Jenny Malcolm, discovered Les Fleurs de la Mémoire last summer. He says the organization has enabled him to honor the American soldiers who sacrificed their lives for his country and for liberty.
Du fond du cœur, avec...
With enormous emotion in my heart, I want to say thank you, Walter, says Miette. I will never forget you or your heroic compatriots.
Je ne t'oublierai jamais. God bless America.
Since Les Fleurs de la Mémoire brought them together, Jean-Michel Miette and Jenny Malcolm now speak regularly on the telephone. Jenny Malcolm says she feels her uncle Walter finally has family to visit his grave. As a lone trumpet plays taps, Memorial Day at Colville-sur-Mer draws to a close. I'm Eleanor Beardsley at the American Cemetery in Colville-sur-Mer, France.
It's been almost 2 months since the Iraqi army launched an operation to gain control of Basra. That's the largest city in southern Iraq and the center of the country's main oil-producing region. Before the troops arrived, Basra was in the grip of often feuding Shiite militiamen who imposed a harsh brand of Islam on the local population. Women were particularly at risk. Dozens were killed, targeted for wearing makeup or for refusing to wear a veil in public. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro filed this report.
Nahla's pictures are in frames all around this house, frozen images that the family can hardly bear to look at. A large woman with dyed blonde hair, her images show a preference for bright clothes and red lipstick. Her photographs, though, are now the only spots of color here. Nahla's mother, Samira, and her sister, Iman, still dress in black in mourning for her.
They killed her. She worked at a bank. It's been 2 years now.
Iman says it began with threatening phone calls and notes. The family was terrified.
They claimed that she was not wearing the headscarf as she was supposed to. She began to wear it, and she also began to wear long dresses to cover herself up. When she was killed, she was wearing the full veil.
She sobs as she remembers the day the militia came to kill her sister.
Someone who saw the attack said a car stopped close to her and called her by name. Nahla, Nahla, they said. She turned and then they opened fire. She was riddled with bullets, so many that they broke her bones. We tried to pick her up, but she was bleeding from her head. It was a matter of minutes only. We wish she was alive. We wish they had done anything else but murder her.
The over a dozen women interviewed for this story in Basra from different backgrounds and classes all said essentially the same thing. After the 2003 invasion by U.S. and British forces, their lives got steadily worse and their basic freedoms were eroded. The violence against women in Basra reached its peak last year when, according to the local government, 140 women were killed here, the majority by Shiite militiamen intent on imposing their version of Islamic law on the population. Women were threatened or killed for dressing inappropriately, for playing musical instruments, for singing. Others were pursued because of their jobs. Amnoor is a plump hairdresser with arched brows and a dimpled smile. She's just returned to Basra after 6 months of exile in Iran and Syria. She talks as she plucks a client's eyebrows.
It was Thursday at 3:30 in the afternoon. They stormed my salon, but I had run away seconds before because some neighborhood kids had warned me that some militiamen were pointing at my store. They shot up the building, destroying everything.
Amnoor said she'd previously been warned in a letter that running her beauty shop was haram or forbidden.
It was not only me who was threatened. They threatened all us female hairdressers. Some of those girls fled. Others had their salons burned, but I was among those who stayed.
She says she believed they wouldn't go after her, but they did, and she was lucky to escape with her life. After the Iraqi military operation began 2 months ago, she came back to Basra and started working again. There are now 40,000 Iraqi soldiers and police blanketing the city, and that is allowing women to feel safer. It's graduation day at Basra's university. Young men in caps and gowns parade down a university road, chanting and singing. Women grads in makeup and long, tight-fitting skirts take pictures of the festivities. Nearby, a group of female students from the music department sit together. Until the Iraqi army operation, security at the university was handled by the militias. A kind of morality police would make sure that the girls were appropriately dressed. Several female students were beaten up for not following the draconian rules. 21-year-old Sura Karim Hassan says that no one was brave enough to defy them.
All the students and teachers were afraid of them. They tried to shut down the music department.
Her friend, 22-year-old Amina Ihsan, says the militiamen are no longer around.
When I used to go out of my house, I was afraid to wear trousers, for example, because they would bother us and they would threaten to beat us. And now we have more freedom. I can wear trousers and I can do what I want.
Still, the young women admit that their families don't let them out at night or take any detours to and from school. The militias, they say, have only gone underground. Zainab, who doesn't want her last name used for fear of reprisals, is a lawyer and a women's rights activist in Basra. She says that during the worst of the violence here, there was complete apathy on the part of the Iraqi government and the British, who were supposed to be in control of security in Basra.
We spoke out to try and bring attention to the killings, threats, and kidnappings, but nobody listened to us.
She says Basra also saw an upsurge of honor killings for the same simple reason.
Any man was free to kill his sister or his wife because there was no fear of the law. He knew he would not be punished for his crimes. In fact, some groups actively encouraged these people.
Before the offensive, Zainab used to put makeup on at night and wash it off in the morning before heading into work. It allowed her, she says, to feel more feminine in the confines of her home. Now she's dressed in a white jacket and a form-fitting purple satin skirt. Her toenails are painted with silver glitter. Her makeup looks like it was applied with the giddiness of a teenager. Still, she's afraid.
The stability is temporary. The problems in Basra won't end because all we did was cover these problems up. They did not attack the cause.
Zainab says there is simply no political will to protect women in Basra. Security is better for now, but she's worried about what will happen after the soldiers go. Back across town, Nahla's sister and mother are also pessimistic. When her sister was shot 2 years ago, Iman tried to get the police to help.
I yelled to them, "You are the government. My sister has been killed. You must do something." They replied, "We cannot even protect ourselves."
And then they just drove away. She tried to bring the perpetrators to justice, but no one would even deign to listen to their story.
This is the first visit we have received. No one else has come here to talk to us.
Iman says it's as if her sister had no rights at all. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Basra.
Coming up, a fascination with murder in India.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. In his latest Letter from India, our correspondent in Delhi, Philip Reeves, explains how the wealth gap plays into India's obsession with murder, both fictional and real.
Indians love a juicy murder mystery. The novels of Agatha Christie sell surprisingly well here. You can hear Sherlock Holmes stories on state-run radio, translated into Hindi. Few Bollywood movies are complete without a corpse or two, their lives cut short by breathtaking acts of skullduggery. Real-life murders sell even better. Rarely a week passes without India's TV news channels and newspapers pouncing eagerly on an unusual homicide. A couple of these are burned into my memory. There's the general and his wife, who a few years back were bludgeoned to death. The murder weapon turned out to be the general's ornamental elephant tusks. There's the rich and elderly aunt, found stuffed in a box and covered with salt. The body of her nephew was in a suitcase under the bed. Indians follow such sagas closely, horrified but transfixed. Many other people in many other places would do the same. Yet there is a difference here. The murders that really appeal to the media in India are not just exotic and gruesome, they also play on a fear that exists among the haves about the perceived threat posed by the have-nots. The wider the gap between the rich and poor yawns in this booming nation, the stronger that fear's becoming. Those two killings I've just mentioned were both blamed on the servants of the victims. Anyone with money in India, including the middle class, usually employs servants. Some of these servants work shockingly long hours for appallingly low wages. When a murder's committed in the home, they're often blamed, whether guilty or not. Sometimes, of course, they're not the culprits. In fact, it's rare for servants to kill their employers. The big murder story obsessing Delhi at the moment is about the 14-year-old daughter of two well-known dentists. When her body was found in a prosperous new town outside Delhi, the cops immediately blamed the Nepali servant. They even circulated his photo. That version stuck for a full news cycle. It turned out investigators didn't bother to look on the terrace, a few yards from the dead girl, where the servant also lay dead. This was a huge embarrassment for the authorities. But perhaps some good will come of it. Perhaps now, India's police won't be so quick automatically to lay the blame on the easiest target, the poor and powerless. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
We'll be right back. For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.